Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
You've been listening to the Estate...
What now?
I was trying to end the show already.
Oh, no.
We're off before...
We're off before you started.
Hey, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the first Herzog Law Firm Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour of 2022. I'm Harry Miller.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Dave Kabakian.
And Dave and I, as you know, are two of the attorneys with the Herzog Law Firm. We are conveniently located in Saratoga Springs, Clifton Park, Albany, and Kingston, New York. And we are here each Saturday morning to answer your questions, answer your phone calls, get you some good information, interesting stuff about estate planning, Medicaid asset protection planning, estate administration, wills, trusts, beneficiary designations, gift giving, you know, tax issues and stuff like that. So David and I would be happy to entertain your calls this morning. Here in the studio, you can pick up your phone and dial us direct at 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. So first, let me just, I want to wish everyone a very, very happy 2022. I was thinking driving up to the studio this morning that, you know, 2020 and 2021 weren't exactly better years. So, you're like, I'm hoping maybe... I don't know what you think, Dave, but I'm hoping maybe that 2022 will be a little better.
It's going to be better, Harry, because we have no choice. We just have to make it better, right? That's the mindset we got to have. And what's really funny is that last year was our Herzog Law Firm's 75th anniversary.
Right.
And we didn't actually realize that until about May because we didn't feel like 2020 counted as a year. You know what I mean?
So, the lost year.
It was the lost year, but apparently it did count with ages and everything like that, so it must count for anniversaries. I think it's going to be better. I mean, you know, right now I'm in the office, you're in the studio, and one of the reasons is because during our little break here last couple of weeks, my family and I all got COVID, and even though I sound probably not very good right now, it's just more of it's early in the morning, and didn't sleep very well type of thing. But we were asymptomatic. My wife had a bad flu-like day.
Yeah.
But I cannot tell you guys, I cannot tell our listeners how many people I know who have told me or I heard have had this apparently new version of the virus, new variant,
in the
last couple of weeks. And knock on wood, everyone, you know, only one or two of them had a tough go, and I'm talking about like 40 or 50 people I know that have had it. So the optimist in me says, well, the more people who get it who have very light to no symptoms, maybe that's a good thing for the beginning of the end rather than the end of the beginning, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So we'll see.
You're right. Yeah, it is.
Cross your fingers.
Testing is, I tell you, we had an interesting experience after Christmas. My wife and I went down to visit some old friends in Connecticut for a couple of days, and we had a great reunion. And what we hadn't seen, they have two kids who were in, and they all hadn't been together in like 5 or 6 years because their son's a film editor. He lives in Los Angeles, and their daughter is a news reporter. She lives in Dubai in the Middle East. And she's been there for 15 or 20 years. And, of course, she was flying back to Dubai the day after we were leaving. And she had to get, like, two tests 24 and 48 hours before she could get on the airplane. She was flying on, like, Emirates Air. And she said that Dubai is very, very strict about letting people in. And, of course, they're all vaccinated and boosted. But she had to go to a place about half hour away in Niantic, Connecticut, to get the first test. And then the second test was scheduled somewhere in Bridgeport, Connecticut, which is like an hour from where they leave.
Oh, geez.
So they call the morning of the test. They call her, email her, and said, I'm sorry, we've closed the Bridgeport office. We're not doing testing there anymore. And she's like, said, oh, my God, I can't get on the plane tomorrow night if I don't have a test. So my wife figured out she wound up getting a test at Kennedy Airport. You could get a test. She signed up, got a test, and they guaranteed the result within 2 hours. So she had to take a limo to Kennedy, got the test.
Oh, my goodness.
Got on the plane. She was negative and got back to Dubai in time for New Year's Eve. It was, and
wow.
It cost like $300 for the test, but she said it didn't matter. So that's how hard it is to get tested.
It's crazy times, Harry.
Yeah, amazing.
You know, for the holidays, my family, we were in Los Angeles, and that's apparently where, you know, we had a relative who ended up, unbeknownst to them, having the virus, and that's how we all got it. But we found out when we got back to New York. But sign of the times, right around LAX, you know, we're kind of on our way to the airport. I got to get gas in the rental car so they don't ding me for
charging, you know,
$10 a gallon.
Yeah.
Oh, please, it's like 10 now. Like, on opposing corners, kitty corner, at every intersection around the airport was, get your COVID testing here, get your COVID testing here. It's like a little business now because people who are traveling, especially international, do need to get tests done.
Yeah.
So it's just like, you know, the free market, and you know, just wait and see, and right. COVID testing everywhere, and then eventually there'll be antibody testing here and there. Anyway, hopefully all of our listeners
are doing well.
Dave,
we got our first caller. Paul in Boston Spa is on the line. So good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Paul.
Hey, welcome to the show. How are you?
Good. My question is, if someone puts their home in their children's name, will that protect it from the 5-year look-back period if you go into a nursing home?
Paul, I have a question for you. Have you been listening to the conversations Harry and I have been having in the office this past week? Literally, Paul,
Is that a great segue?
It's unbelievable. Paul, Harry and I were talking this week. I had a client who did something like what you're saying. They took their house and they transferred it to their children. And what people often do, and what you're probably thinking about, is that you would retain certain rights in your home, right? You would still live in your home, but you're going to deed it over to the kids. Is that what you were talking about?
That's correct.
So that's called a life estate deed. And so let me answer your question real quick. It starts the look back period. It does start the clock towards the 5-year look back period, but Harry and I are going to get into this a little bit. So if you want to like hang up, we totally understand. Because I want everyone else out there to understand what this deed is and the potential flaws, because Harry's got a bunch of flaws for it. So, Harry, let me set it up with what it is, and then thank you so much. And then, Harry, knock it down with all the awful things that might happen with it.
Do you need a driver or 3-wood for this one?
I'm going to tee it up, so get that big boy out, okay? Driver time.
You've never seen me hit the big boy, have you?
That's all right. Sorry. If anyone's 50 yards to the left of you, watch out. So everyone out there who owns a home, you own the home forever and ever. The way that you have title is that it will be yours from now till the end of time. The simple title is what it's called. And between now and the end of time, what's going to happen? You're going to pass away. And it might be your estate that owns the home for the rest of the end of time. But unless there's something in there, a probate, someone who has the authority to sell it, transfer it, it's always going to be in this chain, in this line. And one of the things people can do, and our caller just mentioned it, and I've had family members that have done it, is you could do something called a life estate deed. Harry can deed me his home, and he and his wife can retain the use and occupancy, exclusive use and occupancy of their home for the rest of their lives, if they want. But technically, they transferred the house to me now. Their retained use and enjoyment of that property means that taxes, STAR exemptions, are based on their lives. Mm-hmm. It means that the 5-year look-back period could start ticking for purposes of Medicaid, because no longer can Harry and his wife sell that home. More on that later. But they can't buy themselves
and I don't have
sell
to
their home
you,
anymore.
I don't have to let you in the door either. I said, come back when I'm dead,
absolutely
right?
Not.
Come back when I'm dead.
When Harry deeded that home to me, he didn't give me the garage door opener. He kept it. Okay? So what it can do, let's talk about the positives, and then, Harry, it's all yours. Mm-hmm. We could avoid probate, right? Property doesn't have beneficiaries. But if I, you know, Harry gives me the property now, subject to this life use, which will end when he and his wife die, well, that's almost like a beneficiary. I could avoid probate. If he can't sell it by himself anymore, Medicaid's going to say, well, if 5 years have gone by, there you go, Harry. You just protected this property.
Right.
Sounds good. What can possibly go wrong, Harry?
Well, a lot of things. Here's the problem here. David, you're now on the deed to my house, okay? So if I want to sell the house, I can't do that, first of all, unless you sign the deed. And there's nothing, you know, that I could do to compel you to sign the deed. Also, if you do sign the deed, I'm going to have to give you some of the money from the sale of the house, right? Because a life estate, I've essentially divided the ownership into two components, the part that represents the value of my life and my wife's life estate, and the value of what David owns. And guess what? As you get older, your life expectancy gets shorter. And so my piece of the pie, every year I have a birthday, gets smaller, and David's gets bigger, okay? So if I sold the house, I might have to give him half of the money or 60% of the money if I'm 85 or 90 years old. Well, I never intended to do that. You know, I intended if I sold the house, it would be mine, and I could, like, go buy another house or something or put it in the bank. The other thing is, if it's my house, if my principal residence as opposed to an investment property, and I sell it, David has got his own house. He doesn't live in my house. So the exclusion of capital gain from the sale of your principal residence, I'm going to lose it. If David gets half of the money from the sale of the house and I have a $200,000 capital gain, guess what? Half of that, 100 grand, is going to get taxed. And somebody's either here or I, somebody's got to pay the tax on that to the IRS and the state of New York. So this is a big downside of having a house. The other thing is, what happens if something happens to David? All right?
Hey, now.
What?
Be nice. What do you mean? What's going to happen to me?
You know, you develop some chronic illness and wind up in the nursing home, God forbid.
How ironic would that be, by the way?
Yeah, God, you get hit by a bus. Guess what now? David is on my deed. He gets hit by a bus, and his house maybe passes to his two little kids, who are minors. All right? Guess what? If your property is owned by...
They're your new co-owners.
Alex and Jackie, can I want to refinance my home equity. Would you? Well, they can't even legally consent. They're underage.
Nope.
So when a minor owns an interest in a piece of real property, guess what? You cannot sell it, rent it, mortgage it, or do anything with it without a court order. So, well, it's an example of the mess you create potentially. Through unforeseen circumstances. These are things, unforeseen circumstances. They may never happen. But if you put the piece of real estate in a trust, you avoid all of those issues. You avoid all the issues of changing ownership, signing the deed. You preserve the capital gains tax exclusion. You can make sure the property never falls in the hands of a minor, even if a minor is the beneficiary of the trust. The trust is a separate legal entity, and the trusts that we create for people give you the power to control the use and ownership of the property in the trust, also who the trustee is and who gets the money. So, and if something happens then, if something happens to the beneficiary who's on your deed, if they die, if they become disabled, we can change the beneficiary or set it up in a trust for that disabled beneficiary so we don't expose it to Medicaid liens, we don't expose it to creditors' claims or ownership by a minor. So it's a real, well, enough said, I guess.
So Harry, you're clearly bad cop in this little fact pattern. I'm good cop. I'm going to keep saying the good stuff about it. You keep saying the bad stuff about it because, look, my family did one for my grandfather.
A life estate.
My grandfather, a life estate deed, absolutely.
Okay.
And he was, I think, 89 years old when we did it. My mother is an only child. My grandfather was a widower. He was in a house in Bayside, Queens, that he had been in for about 45 years, maybe longer. A lot of money was in that, a lot of built-in gain. You better believe he probably bought it for 20 grand. It was probably worth 800 grand
right,
at the time he passed. Even though the interior looked exactly the same as it always did. It's quite amazing. But Life is easy, right? He was going to leave everything to his sole child, his daughter, who's my mother. He was going to be, you know, the only way he was leaving that house was going to be, you know, on a gurney of some sort. And we wanted to get the five-year clock ticking just in case he couldn't stay home. There were no other assets of his that needed protection. He had a small pension. He had Social Security. So, you know, could we have done a trust? Sure. Right? I'm his grandson. I wasn't going to charge him for trust, right? Easily could have done a trust. But for that fact pattern, what was appropriate was a life estate deed. And the potential negatives that you're mentioning weren't things that were going to realistically happen. But I think the most important fact of that is that he was really old. And he was, you know, we're going to talk later on about how an age back then isn't an age now. And you'll see what I mean in a little bit. But, you know, 89, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, is different than 89 now.
Right.
So we were pretty sure he wasn't going to go anywhere. There was no one to fight this or anything.
I agree. In those circumstances, it makes perfect sense to do that. Absolutely.
And it's cheap. It's a lot cheaper than doing a trust. And, you know, we're not the type of people who say, well, you have to do a trust. You don't have to do anything. Right. You need to know your options and look at the pros and cons. Now, Harry, the one negative you didn't mention is the reason why I brought this up to you. It was a particular existing client of ours who 3 years ago, similar to what Paul was thinking, let's get this clock ticking. I'm not going to speak for you, Paul, but this client didn't have a ton of other things that would go into the trust. Most of them were small financial accounts with beneficiaries, i.e. they're already avoiding probate. They're not a ton of money that needed protection. She said, you know what, Dave, I hear you on the trust. I don't want to spend thousands. I want to spend hundreds, and I'll do this deed you're talking about, life estate deed. And she left it all to her daughter. The life estate deed to her daughter, assuming that her plan, her who gets my money one day when I'm not here, that plan would always include her daughter. Just like we assumed my grandfather's plan would always include my mother. Right. However, the reason why our client came back in, Harry, is because she and her daughter had a colossal falling out, one that is likely to never get repaired. And she came in to change her will. She wants to leave things to grandchildren. Mm-hmm. But the biggest asset she's got, that house, it is forever and ever going to be going to one person now.
Right.
And that's her daughter, because she did a life estate deed. And you always talk, Harry, about how important it is for people to maintain control on their assets and be able to change their mind. And when you do something like a life estate, it could really work out for you. But if things change, you lost control of that asset. Wait a minute, what if I put in a trust? With our trusts, you can change your beneficiary. You can change the result.
Right. It's just these things happen in families. We have fallings out. We have irretrievable breaches that occur that we never foresaw happening. And you're absolutely right, because if she had deeded the house to the trust, even if her daughter was the trustee of the trust, okay, she could have, A, changed the trustee from her daughter to her granddaughter, assuming she's an adult, and she could have changed the beneficiary of the house from her daughter to her granddaughter, or to anyone else she would have chosen to leave it to. Now she's locked into a fact pattern that without her daughter's signature, you can't change it. You can't, once it's deeded.
She can't even sell her home, Harry.
What? She can't sell the house.
Sell her home.
She wants to sell the house and move into a senior living place where she pays an entrance fee or even just a straight rental. And the daughter says, no, I'm not signing no deeds. You know,
she's going to have to go through a litigation to make that happen. It's you know, and I totally get why people do that kind of deed. You know, Paul, if you want to call back, please feel free. Paul, you sounded kind of young. I'd say, you know, your age probably starts with a 6, maybe a low 7, right? That's a lot of life left. There's a lot of, hey, you know what? We were talking before we got on how darn cold it is outside. I don't want to be cold my whole life anymore. I'm going to move to Florida. Well, we need everyone to agree. And I don't think someone whose age starts with a 6 or a 7 should be doing life estate deeds. Obviously, there's exceptions, but, you know, you got to keep your options
open. They don't work. For the most part, they don't work. A lot of lawyers do them. We have done them in the past. We really try to talk folks out of them. There are occasions where they insist, but when they insist, we want to point out all the possible risks that we just went over the last several minutes of what can happen if you do that. It just for the most part does not make a lot of sense. It's because of people change their minds. I saw this thing in a paper the other day with this guy wrote in and he said, "Look, I've been taking care of my mother, my elderly mother, for like 15 years. And she wrote down a will that says that she wants me to get her house when she dies because of my other three sisters and brothers. I'm the one who's been taking care of her, living with her, and doing all of her errands and her medical appointments and stuff. So do I have a claim?" So as it turns out, guess what? 10 years before that, the mother put the house in all four kids' names with a reserve life estate. Now, we have changed circumstances here. So what's going to happen? Nothing. You know, what's going to happen is, if all four kids are on the deed, when she passes away, even if she has a will that says, "I want my house to go to my son because he took care of me," it doesn't pass anything because she doesn't own the house anymore. So
yeah.
her circumstances, her goals and objectives has changed, her relationship with her children has changed, and she now wants to confer this benefit on this son who's taking care of her when the other three haven't bothered all that much, but she's locked herself out of that option.
Yeah, Harry, and you know, wills, you could change your will whenever you feel like it. You could amend your trust if, you know, with at least the vast majority of trusts we do, you can absolutely amend your trust and change the who gets what whenever you feel like it. Right, so just a basic will gets it done. But real estate gets tricky because once we put other people's names on property, you know, we're kind of locked in, or at least we need everyone to agree, which could be really problematic. The prospective client that came yesterday to Saratoga here, he's a big hunter. He's wearing camouflage. He had a camouflage hat. And he mentioned that his family has some land that they hunt on. And I said to him, "Funny, I didn't take you for a hunter." And he said, "Wait, what?" And his wife just started dying laughing because I was kidding with him. But he and his friend and two of his brothers and his dad, they all love hunting. What do they do? They love hunting. They bought a bunch of land. I think it's like 100 acres of land. They love it way up north. They hunt. They enjoy it. Guess what? They own it as five individual people, meaning that when one of them, God forbid, passes away, or one of them, God forbid, is incapacitated, now their co-owners is the estate of my friend or the estate of my father, or maybe it's going to be the spouse of my friend. And maybe that spouse isn't into hunting, right? When it comes to real estate, I know we started with life estate deeds, but this is a bigger topic here. Well, you got to know how you own property, and you got to know what happens when someone dies. Yeah,
something like that with a group ownership like that, I would normally recommend they put the thing into a limited liability company. Okay,
yeah.
That the five of them would own, and then when they pass on the shares, first of all, one thing you want to do when that happens is you probably want to give the other four guys the option to buy out the dead guy, right? Instead of having to go to his wife or his kids, it's a closed club, and you can structure a limited liability arrangement so that before anybody can offer it to somebody else, the other four people get a right to buy out whatever the value of it is. And that way you can keep it. I do that a lot with family summer places. Folks who have places up in Lake George or out in Lake out in Rensselaer County someplace. And the problem is, as people die, the ownership gets bifurcated into all of a sudden you got 8 or 10 or 12 or 15 people who have a legal interest in this house, and they can't agree on anything.
Or they move out of town, you know. Like it's very romantic, you know. I want my kids, my kids who grew up going to the lake or going to the camp. I want their kids to enjoy it.
Well, you
right?
know what that is.
I want my grandkids to enjoy it.
As long as grandma and grandpa are paying the taxes and the insurance, everybody wants to go. But all of a sudden, grandma and grandpa aren't around anymore, and now you got to split it up four ways. And Sonny Boy lives out in California and says, "Hell, I haven't been there in 3 years. I'm not picking in my share." So what do you do with that situation?
Harry, 1,000%. Here's a better one. Everyone is local. Everyone loves the place. Everyone keeps using it.
Right.
Last I saw, it still has 2 bedrooms, and there's only one July 4th weekend every year. Who gets to use it? Right? You mean I get to go Memorial Day when the water's still cold? Forget about it. I'll take Labor Day. But these are things that mom and dad, grandma and grandpa, they could actually work it all out. It could be in an LLC. It could be even language in their trust. There's all sorts of options, but
yeah, it's great.
Let them happen without planning.
I've done dozens of these over the years for families, and I have, you know, I have a lot of different templates depending upon the nature and characteristics of the families. And there really are ways, any of you out there that own summer property, at some point you're all going to have this problem in your family. And one of the ways to deal with this successfully is to think about something like a limited liability. The other thing is, and every time some ownership passes, you don't have to do a deed and pay $250 right. bucks to the county clerk. You arrange the ownership interest. You know, a limited liability company, it's like a corporation, but it gets taxed like a partnership. And so it has the dual advantage of insulating you from liability from claims. And also, the tax aspects, the tax advantages of passing through income, gain, loss, deduction, and credit to the family members. And it's a perfect way to own a diverse, you know, use, a multi-use piece of property like a summer place on a lake or on the ocean someplace.
Harry, I know we're coming up slowly onto the break, but I'll tell you a really quick fact pattern where it was a litigation involving an island on Lake George. So obviously, if you've been to Lake George, lots of different islands. Some of them are publicly owned and you can camp out.
Yeah,
some are privately owned.
There's an island up there. There's only about 8 or 10 houses on it. Yeah, I have. Yeah, there's several of them, I think.
Yeah. So this particular property, this island, has been owned by the same family for almost 100 years. And they have a constitution. Essentially like an operating agreement. Mm-hmm. It rules and regs. There's dues, there's annual meetings. At this point, it's third cousins, second cousins. And they have rules because it's just an agreement, right? You could put whatever rules you want, Harry. So, for example, if you're the spouse of a shareholder, first of all, a shareholder can only be someone who's a blood relative of the creators of this entity. If you are the first spouse, and you are the surviving spouse of such a member, you can continue to use the island, Harry. However, upon your death, it has to go to other blood relatives. If you're the second spouse, those rights don't exist. I had the litigation involved the second spouse and involved the daughter, who was a blood relative, and now, or at least I don't know what happened since I handled the matter, but daughter now has two camps on the same island because she had bought one herself because she didn't want to wait for something bad to happen to dad. She wanted to enjoy it too. And now she got dad.
Dave, we got to go to the break. We'll be right back.
Oh, I apologize.
After the break, and we'll follow right up.
Law Firm.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for, options available for Medicaid planning, and more. With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany, West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs, Executive Woods in Clifton Park, and 130 North Front Street in Kingston, our attorneys are here to help you. If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David, Jane Marie, or Harry, please call us during normal business hours Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581. Our Saratoga Springs office, 518-581-8131. Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010. And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405. Let the Herzog Law Firm help navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
And welcome back to the Herzog Law Firm Estate Medicaid Planning Hour. I'm Harry Miller.
Good morning. I'm Dave Kubikian.
And Dave and I have been talking the last half hour about some issues, important issues that arise when you are thinking about doing a life estate deed as opposed to putting a piece of real estate into a trust or in certain kinds of vacation properties into a limited liability company. So, Dave, do you want to pick up where we left off right before the break?
Yeah, well, first of all, Paul was our caller. You see what you started here, Paul? You had a very simple, basic question. What do we think about putting a house in the name of your kids? Does it help with protecting? The answer is yes, it does. It maybe protects things a little too much, though, because it may keep you from being able to do what you want with that property down the road. Mm. It assumes everyone's going to be healthy and happy and all the relationships are going to stay as is. And sometimes that doesn't happen. And then even if everyone all agrees, yeah, you know what, Dad and Mom are going to move down to Florida. Let's sell this property. That five-year protection was for the house. It doesn't extend to the money you receive when that house closes. That's now your money. It's a resource. It's not protected. And more importantly, it might be your kids, and likely your kids are going to get a lot more of the proceeds of that sale than you do, because their interest, as Harry was saying, is a lot larger than yours is.
Hey, David.
It gets complicated, Harry.
Hey, Dave, we got another caller here. Gary from Glenville, the GG. Gary from Glenville's on the line. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning. Hi, Harry. Hi, David. Happy New Year to you. And thank you for your service. I don't know, maybe you can help me here, and I'll try to explain it the best I can. I am trustee of an irrevocable trust for my brother. We've put the real estate and savings and some investments in there, but the issue is, and he has a non-qualified annuity. It has like a $350,000 gain in it, mm-hmm. and the non-qualified annuity is in his Social Security number,
right.
And when I called the insurance company to do the change of ownership and put it into the trust, which has a separate tax ID number, they were not helpful or couldn't tell me if it's a taxable event and would that gain all be taxable because we're changing the ownership. I don't know, you know, what right. the rules are on that, or is that something that is taxable or not taxable? Because, well, you know,
that's the question. Obviously, look at the trust, first of all.
Okay.
If it is, annuities are peculiar creatures because there's three components to annuity. There is the owner mm-hmm. of the annuity, the person who owns the annuity. There is a beneficiary who would be the people who would pick up whatever is undistributed from the annuity on death of the annuitant. And then the annuitant.
Well, right now,
was the measuring life.
I'm the beneficiary, and my brother's the beneficiary. But the trust is the beneficiary, you know,
of the annuity.
No. It's in an individual name now. The trust. If you put it into the trust,
If you change the owner to the trust,
yes.
then it could trigger gain if the trust is a grantor type trust for income tax purposes. It should mm-hmm. not trigger a taxable event by changing the ownership to the trust. Now, you can't change the annuitant, all right?
Right.
But you could change the owner, all right? And sometimes what I do is I will do that. And, in fact, I had a situation a couple of years ago where I did change a non-qualified annuity, which, for those of you out there, a non-qualified annuity is essentially an insurance contract you buy. You pay $100,000 or whatever. You buy an annuity contract from an insurance company, and then it either goes up or down, and in this case, it's gone up substantially to the tune of $350,000. The appreciation in an annuity, unlike stocks and mutual funds, when you distribute it or cash it in, is taxed as ordinary income, not long-term capital gain. So the tax consequences of annuities are far more unfavorable than if you sell stocks and bonds because you have long-term capital gain. So if we transfer, normally if you transferred the ownership of the annuity to something that was not recognized as the same taxpayer, you could trigger that gain simply by transferring the ownership. In that situation, it shouldn't happen. I had a client where we did that. We put the annuity into the trust, and at the end of, it was 2 years ago in January, they sent him a 1099 for like $75,000 of gain, of income. I said, wait a minute, that isn't right. And this was a big, it was one of the major insurance companies. We wrote back to them. I told them it was a grantor trust for income tax purposes, and therefore the change of ownership to the annuity was not taxable as ordinary income. And they corrected it. They sent a corrected 1099. And sometimes these. So the key to it is getting an analysis of what type of trust your brother has. Okay.
Well, how do you tell if it's a grantor trust, I guess?
If it is a grantor trust, you just want to make sure of that before you actually change the annuity ownership over. That's all.
Is that somewhere in the trust document?
Well, you'd have to not in any plain sense of it. I mean, did we do the trust or not? No.
No. No.
Then we'd have to look at the trust.
You'd have to look at it. Okay.
Our asset protection trusts, and I think that's what you're talking about here.
Yeah.
Are specifically designed to be grantor type trusts for income tax purposes. So all the income is passed through to the beneficiary, who's currently your brother. And so because of that, it should also defer any taxable gain recognition of income by transferring the ownership to the grantor trust, because your brother is still the beneficiary. Okay, so it shouldn't trigger it until later on down the road. Don't rely on me to do that, please, without having me read the
Yeah, someone's got to look at it.
Okay. Because you're talking about a boatload of gain here. Here's the reason we would do it, okay? Because sometimes, maybe not in that situation because there's a huge amount of gain, if your brother went into a nursing home, he's still going to have to draw money out of that annuity, whether it's in the trust or not, because he is the annuitant. And so the measuring life will still have to take, because a person is in a nursing home, has to maximize income. Therefore, he'd have to start drawing out payments from the annuity based upon his age and life expectancy at that time, and which is fine. But if the gain wasn't, we have to measure the gain and the tax on the gain versus spending all that money on the nursing home. Because if the tax is going to be $100,000, which it certainly could be, it could be more than that, all right, it might still be cheaper to pay the tax than pay $180,000 a year to the nursing home. So if we liquidated the annuity and the trust is the beneficiary, we could pull the money into the trust and keep it available to the family. There would be a taxable event there, but it might be less expensive than paying $15,000 a month to the nursing home. That's a decision you can't make now because he may never go to a nursing home. But if he is, we would analyze the tax cost versus the nursing home cost and advise you what we thought was the best approach.
So it's not protected if you put it into the trust,
because he's the annuitant. He still can take annuity payments, even though the trust owns the annuitant, but the trust is not the measuring life. A trust doesn't have a life. A trust is the measuring life has to be a human being, a person with a heartbeat.
Okay.
So even if he went in the nursing home, if he's 85 years old, he's probably going to take $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year out of the annuity. And that's not going to go to the trust. It's going to go to the annuitant, him, and therefore to the nursing home. So, annuities are not so easy to protect inside trusts anymore.
Okay.
You almost have, in order to protect it, you have to cash it in pretty much. Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right.
There are other kinds of Medicaid annuities, but those, we're not talking.
I guess that defeats the whole purpose of doing this. Then
Not necessarily.
No.
Okay. Yeah, it gets a little complicated because one of the good things about the trust. Or the type of trust we do most often, a grantor trust, is we don't see the future. We don't know if we're ever going to need that nursing home. So we don't want to surrender the rights to income from an annuity just because something might happen. But we also know that a non-qualified annuity, has a present value. It actuarially, statistically, it has value, and that's value we can protect. If you said I don't want this annuity anymore, or you want to sell an annuity. So it gets a little complicated because if you said to me, look, in 6 years, I'm going to need a nursing home, and that was factual, well, then I don't want to put an annuity in to a trust and assume it's protected forever and ever, because eventually, if you are in that nursing home and you continue to live in that nursing home, you are still the income beneficiary of the trust. So, none of this stuff is cookie cutter, because each and every fact pattern, age, health, family tree, what's the plan, all matters. Mm-hmm. What are the other assets? So, for example, I don't know if you were listening in the first half hour, we were talking about this thing, a life estate deed. Great idea, unless it's not a great idea. But the facts are going to determine whether it ends up being a good idea or not. It was good for my 89-year-old grandfather, and it's awful for my client who is, in her early 70s now, falling out with her daughter. So you know, I'm not trying to compare this to an annuity, but the idea is it's complicated. Harry would need to look at the trust details.
Okay.
And then look at all the other facts and circumstances. And, I mean, that's kind of why we exist, because it gets really, really complicated, and at least you could have, you know, an expert, us or someone else, really take a peek at it and kind of give you a diagnosis, so to speak. You know, it's tough on the phone.
It is.
Thanks so much for your phone call, though.
The problem with annuities annuities is that the income, the tax consequence never goes away. Either you have it, or your beneficiaries are going to have to take distributions and pay the tax. In stocks and bonds, when a person dies, all those stocks and capital investment assets get revalued to what they're worth on the date of death, and so the unrealized gain goes away. But it never goes away in an annuity, because the buildup is taxable as ordinary income. But, you know, it's deferred. It's not tax free. It's tax deferred. So anyway. Hopefully, we haven't totally confused you. Anyway.
Thanks for the call.
No, thank you. I appreciate your help and input on this. Thank you so much.
Anytime. And you know, you can always call us. Our office is 465-7581, and we can talk further on the phone, or you can come in for an appointment. Jennifer in Saratoga County is on the line waiting for us. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning. How are you?
We're pretty good.
What's going on?
For a cold Saturday morning, not too bad.
All right. So I have a little bit, it's kind of a two-part question. I took care of my 98-year-old grandfather before he passed, and he wanted me to keep the house and the family. At that time, I liked to move around. I was like, okay, big property, 6 acres, two-bedroom house, single. Mm. I have no kids. So my brother was going through his divorce, and I said, well, he needs somewhere to stay, being the nice guy, and brought him in. But I did not want anything to do with the mortgage. So his name is on the mortgage. But I thought, to protect myself with the property, I put myself on the deed. So we're both on the deed. He is on the mortgage. I'm at the point now where I don't really want to live with him any longer. I'm now in my mid-40s. I want to have my own space. So he is under the impression, because he is on the mortgage and his name is on the insurance, that he owns the house.
So he's incorrect on that. He is an owner of the home, as you are. Because you guys are both on the deed. That's what you said, right? Your both names are on the deed.
That is
now, so some bank out there said, you know what, he is credit worthy enough that they will lend him money so that you guys could have acquired this property, or whatever the kind of backstory is. And that means that the mortgage, the lien on the property, exists, and it's going to affect your ability to sell the property, because it's a mortgage, right? The mortgage has to be resolved in some way before you can just up and get out. But it's a little more complicated for him, because he also had signed a promissory note. When someone signs a mortgage, it's a couple documents. One is his obligation to pay the payments on the mortgage, called a promissory note. Both your names should be on the insurance, but his lender would require at least his name to be on the insurance. Really, they should probably require both names. So the long and short of it is, if you want to get out of that, right, he can buy you out of your interest. You can't force his hand to do a sale without, you know, a prolonged litigation. He does not own the property by himself. You are an owner. But he does have a lot more responsibility with respect to that house. You know, him not paying the note could affect his credit worthiness in the future and his credit scores and things like that. That wouldn't impact yours, because you don't have that obligation. But it's, you know, certainly not the most ideal fact pattern. And, you know, for listeners out there, I wouldn't recommend, hey, two of you buy a house and one of you get the loan, and, you know, it gets complicated, especially now. So it sounds like maybe he doesn't understand that, or doesn't feel the need to buy you out of your interest.
Whoever's going to stay in the house, whoever's going to wind up staying in the house would need to buy out the other's half interest, and then probably refinance the mortgage if you're going to buy him out. Refinance the mortgage if you can do that, and take him off so he no longer has personal liability on the debt.
Well, you want to get out of there, though, right, Jennifer?
Yeah, I do.
You're the one that wants to leave.
Okay.
Right, because in the long of it is that our properties, my mom's properties and my younger brother's are all side by side, and that kind of gets into the second part question with my mom's portion. Because my father passed away, and now her property is in her name, but that's the second question. So the second part of my first question is, sorry, is if I left...
Jennifer, how many parts are there to this question? Be honest with us. It sounds like a four-parter.
Part two of question one. We haven't got to question two yet.
It's three. This is helpful for all on the listening on the air here. Don't buy a house with your brother or your sister.
No good deed goes unpunished.
If I vacated the property, am I vacating my rights to that house?
No, you still own it. You still own half the house.
Jennifer, let me ask you a question. All these years, how are bills getting paid?
I pay the electric, cable, and then I've been giving him cash which now I'm not going to do, for the mortgage. We've been splitting the mortgage. We don't have any written agreements, nothing. I've just been giving him half of what the mortgage is.
And I assume that the mortgage payment includes an escrowed amount for the taxes and insurance?
That is correct.
So this whole time you've been, you know, if we did all the math, you guys would be pretty close to even because you had been paying him as part of the mortgage, but really it's part of that escrow, right? You have been paying taxes. You have been paying insurance.
You've been splitting everything, and then you have to figure out what the net equity is. If the property is worth $150,000, and there's a $100,000 mortgage on it, there's only $50,000 in net equity.
Correct.
So if he bought you out, if he assumed a liability on the mortgage and gave you $25,000, that would be essentially buying you out. I mean, all other things being equal.
So, right.
You know, Harry, it actually would be pretty straightforward because, Jennifer, because your name's not on the loan doesn't have to be refinanced. It's just a matter of whether your brother has cash.
And if he's cash-strapped or something, you could agree to take something back over a period of 5 or 10 years, if you can afford to do that. I mean, there are a lot of ways to work this out if you're both agreeable to working it out. I mean, I don't see, unless you're at odds with each other, that it doesn't seem like this should be an irresolvable problem for both of you. And it might work being both of your best interests to part with ownership and separate it out at this point if he wants to continue to live there. I think this is a really soluble problem.
Yeah, well, Harry, I was, you know, I'm positive in terms of other things. I'm negative when it comes to stuff like this. I'm sensing that, Jennifer, your brother doesn't think he owes you a dime. He thinks he owns the whole thing.
Right, and that was from his message that he sent me yesterday, is that he's like, no, I own 3/4 of the trust, and the house and everything is in my name. And then I said, no, that's not correct because I'm on the deed. And then he said, well, he's like, you know, he promised my father before he died, because my dad gifted half of the value of the house, and then we had to pay the uncle out his half. So he, in his opinion, feels like he owns the whole deal, and he just let me stay there. And that's obviously paper.
Well, Jennifer,
go ahead, Harry, I'm sorry.
The first thing we got to do is figure out who owns what, because there's obviously a divergence of opinion here about how much of the house he owns and how much you own, and that shouldn't be that hard to figure out.
No, it's not. Literally, both of our names are on that deed, and he's just on the mortgage. I think he's just
Yeah, well, the mortgage does not evidence ownership. It evidences a liability and a debt, you know. So,
Jennifer, I think it's appropriate for you to gather everything you got about all this stuff and come in one day, Saratoga, Clifton Park, wherever you want, and we kind of clear the table and spread the stuff out, because I think there's probably going to be a difference between what relatives may have wanted and what the documents actually reflect. And that's not an uncommon thing. It's actually pretty common, right? Well, Dad told me he wanted me to live here. Well, did Dad tell his attorney when the documents were drafted, or the real estate attorney when the deed was prepared? So there might be a little bit of ego massaging, for lack of a better term, to just clear the air. And it's really hard for you and your brother to have productive conversations if you both believe the facts are different. But the facts are the facts. There's no alternative facts here. The facts are this is what the deed says, this is what the mortgage says, this, this is what's been paid when. And as Harry said, let's first get the lay of the land, and then you guys could have really productive conversations. And I do agree with Harry. I think at the end of the day, this is something that can be resolved easily, but not yet, because you guys are in different stratospheres in terms of the reality.
Gotcha.
So good luck.
Good luck.
Thank you.
We're always here to help, you know, if we can. That's, you know, that's what we do.
It was so ironic that you guys were talking about this morning on the radio. Really just had this blow up yesterday about it. Crazy.
Well, you could thank Paul for bringing it up to begin with at the bottom of the hour, or the top of the hour. Take care.
All right. Have a good weekend.
Okay. All right, bye.
We do have another caller. We have Joanne from Selkirk.
Morning, Joanne.
Hi, Joanne.
Hello. Hi, good morning. I was calling because my mom recently passed away, and we haven't met with the attorney yet. There is a family trust that my dad left behind. But my question is, as before we meet with the attorney, I am really ignorant. I don't understand what probate is. And that's really my question today.
You want to know what probate is, huh? Well, you came to the right place. So probate is a legal term, and it's like, not to give you the history of it, but it's you know, to prove, it's the proving of the will. So not every will has to go through probate, because a will doesn't necessarily take charge of every asset someone owns. So for example, sorry about her passing, by the way. If there are assets that have beneficiaries on them, then we know that that asset's going to go to that beneficiary, because that's the way that the life insurance was formulated. That's the way the bank account was titled. That's the way the house was titled, right? There was a trust that held assets. So it's not a will that governs that asset, because mom didn't own it when she died. Her trust did. So probate is a technical term when a will needs to go through the courts to be proven. Not for the courts to say this will was a great idea. It's for the courts to say, hey, if anyone wants to fight this thing, you know, and you have the proper standing, you could fight it.
It's like a wedding. Speak now or forever hold your peace.
Exactly.
Oh, really?
If there weren't enough witnesses, was this done the right way? There are certain presumptions, certain check marks on the checklist that the court goes through. And we really like when people avoid it, because a lot of times this is unnecessary. A lot of times it's costly. And if at worst, or best, I guess, super time consuming. So a lot of times our clients come in and they have a trust. Either we did it or someone else did it. And sometimes we need to do a probate because there was some asset out there that didn't have a beneficiary. It wasn't in the trust. It wasn't co-owned with rights of survivorship. And so we'll have to do a probate. But oftentimes when there's a trust in the mix, and what's left, what was not in the trust, is, you know, mom's bank account, oftentimes there's no need for a probate. When you meet with the attorney, you'll figure it out.
All the assets that are in your father's trust don't have to go through probate, because they're not the only thing that would have to be probated would be, or your mother's, excuse me, if your mother had an account, any kind of account over $15,000 that wasn't in joint names or payable on death to somebody. If she had a life insurance policy and there's a beneficiary, you don't have to probate it. If there's an annuity, or if there are bank accounts or stock accounts that are payable on death or in joint names, those don't have to be probated. They pass on death to the joint owner. So, I mean, she had a $50,000 bank account someplace. It was just in mom's name. You will have to probate the will in order to transfer that bank account. If there's...
Okay, I think we're safe in that respect.
Good.
That was all in order. But I guess my... You know, and I'll find out when we meet with them, but there's a bequeath in the trust that my mom also mentioned it's the same people, but she mentioned different specifications that she, in her will. So I don't understand, is it the trust that makes the bequeath, or is it her will that supersedes the trust?
No,
I don't
no,
understand.
Neither. Each is an independent document. The trust
it
will
is.
Distribute
okay.
the assets. The assets of the trust will have to be distributed in the manner the trust provides. And if there are any assets that pass under the will, they would pass pursuant to the will. But if there's no probate assets, the will essentially becomes irrelevant because it doesn't okay. pass anything.
I see. Right. Okay. Well, I guess I'm going to have a lot of learning to do in the next few months.
Well, you know, a lot of times what happens is that people go through this process with a parent or another loved one, and then they end up coming up with a pretty good plan for themselves because either the process was so awful or because the process was so confusing. But I'm with you because, if you ask someone on the street, they're going to say a will is how all your assets pass. And the reality is that for a lot of people, a will is not how your assets pass. It's the way your asset was titled or the way your asset had a beneficiary or you did a trust. And so the will may not be important at all. It's still important to have a will, but that may not be the document that passes things to who you want. Thanks for the call.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Harry, I got like a minute to talk about Betty White. That's not going to do any justice here. I'm going to have to save this for next week.
We'll get next week, I guess. Or yeah.
I mean, Rose Nyland from the Golden Girls. Yeah. You know?
Yes. I love that show. And God rest her soul. She was a really wonderful woman. Anyway, we'll talk a little bit about Betty White maybe next week. Have a great weekend, everybody, and stay warm.
Take care, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.